Tom Weber on NPR News. The Supreme Court said this week that the Trump administration's travel ban, which is now in its third incarnation, can be enforced while the court challenge continues. And you just heard in the newscast there at the top of the hour that there was a hearing this morning in Virginia about this. And so there's two things happening here at the same time. The court challenge continues. There were these arguments in court this morning. But in these last few days, the travel ban has gone into enforcement. And it's a ban that affects eight countries, six of them home primarily to Muslims. And that includes Somalia. We have a large Somali population here in Minnesota. There's a lot of questions right now for people like John Keller, who heads the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota. John, good to talk to you again. Thanks for coming back.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Jelani Hussein, who's head of CARE Minnesota, the Council on American Islamic Relations. Jelani, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Your questions here today, 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at Weber, Tom One, and please don't call or text if you're driving. So, John, I'm trying to get a sense of how life might be different today for someone, especially in our Somali community, than it was the day before that decision. I think that was Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah, I would say there's a couple important things. For most of the people from these six countries, future permanent immigration is now blocked. So this is, predominantly family petitions. Somebody who has been working through the system, who is a citizen or a permanent resident here in the United States and is waiting to reunite with a spouse or children or a parent, those petitions can often take many, many years. As of the Supreme Court's lifting of the injunctions, those cases, those waits are now indefinitely put on hold.
Jelani, what have you heard this week about that?
Well, I mean, I think it's just here we go again. And, we've had so many ups and downs with this Muslim ban, as we would like to call it, which it is, because President Trump has continuously made policies really affecting the Muslim community. Just in the last week and a half, the retweeting of anti-Muslim bigots in the UK, and most recently the naming Jerusalem as the capital. All of these things just show that the president, one, is surrounding himself with, as we know, Islamophobes who continue to give him these policies or to advocate for these policies. And they have real human consequences. We have families now who have been waiting to reunite, who are not reuniting. Most importantly, it has also emboldened hate mongers in our society who now believe that they can say whatever they want and they can do whatever they want and they can attack Muslims. And actually just in the past 48 hours, we received emails and other forms of communication to our office, the general type of hate mail that we get, and some even more serious. So there are consequences to these policies. There's a consequences to what the Supreme Court did here. And the community is still trying to figure out. And so right now we're encouraging people, if they have even travel plans, particularly those who have different immigrant statuses, that they should reach out to and get a consultation with an immigration attorney.
So, but have you heard examples of it playing out the way John just noted, where maybe, the wife is going to come over, that the husband is here, or vice versa, the wife's here, the husband was going to come over, was planning to fly here on Wednesday, and now can't. I mean, are we at that point now where that stopped?
We haven't heard of the actual immediate someone on their way here, but what we do know is that there's hundreds of families who are already in the process of getting their loved ones here, and others who want to apply and are in the process of applying. And so there isn't that one story that shows the exact nature of this, but just in the reporting, there are a number of families that I know for sure who called our offices who are concerned about what this means for their process. And and I think, it's been an entire year of this. And so many people don't even know what to really make of this this policy. And now it's getting another life to a certain extent.
John, can you point to anything yet at this point of a plane trip that was supposed to happen that hasn't at this point, or are you still sussing it out?
Yeah, we have not had anybody immediately impacted kind of within our clients or people that have approached us. That doesn't mean it hasn't happened. Things are all relatively new. The one thing I would stress and kind of repeat what Jelani said, and that is there's a level of uncertainty that even us as lawyers are trying to navigate through, but particularly the community and community members who are separated from loved ones from these countries. There's a lot of uncertainty. So the uncertainty as to, you know, if you're a student here, for example, and your visa is valid, but it expires in a year, you know, what happens if you go home? We had a lot of those questions after the first travel ban, first Muslim ban back in January. Even people from countries other than the named countries, if they're Muslim, they are worried that, you know, will more countries be added? There's also the uncertainty with this iteration of the travel ban that there's no end date. You know, in the past, it was we needed more time, is what the Trump administration argued. We need, you know, 90 days or 120 days to sort of evaluate our processes. And at the end of that, you know, the ban will be over. With these new proclamation that the president made in September, travel ban 3.0, we call it, there is no end date to some of these policies. And in fact, I think it is prudent to imagine that more countries will be added. I don't want to alarm people, but that's certainly the trajectory. And I think the fear that sits because of this continual trying to refine these orders.
John Keller is with me from the Immigrant Law Center of Minnesota, Jelani Hussein from CARE Minnesota. And both of you have used the phrase Muslim ban, John. And one of the reasons for that was that in some of the court decisions with the earlier versions of the travel ban, 1.0 and 2.0, the judges had said, look, this is we are making this ruling because we believe you are specifically targeting Muslims. This travel ban also includes the nations of Venezuela and North Korea, which from a legal standpoint is a way, as I've understood it, for the Trump administration to say, no, we are not targeting Muslims. We have people from Venezuela and North Korea. Those are not Muslim majority nations. I don't know what you've seen from what came of those court arguments this morning. I know that the side of the court case that wants to throw out the travel ban is still focusing on the Muslim aspect of this, including Donald Trump, the president's retweets and things like that. How do you see that playing out in the court case, John? I know you're not in the courtroom. I know you're not the expert, but you see the nuance there, right? And the difference with this version of the travel ban.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a couple facts that need to be established. You know, the first fact is, I think I saw a report that we accepted maybe 25 or 30 North Koreans last year that, you know, potentially if they applied again would be barred. And similarly, the ban on Venezuela, the other non-Muslim predominant country, it's a very limited prohibition, only on certain government officials or their family members. So in both of those cases, the description that I think makes the most sense is for both North Korea and Venezuela. Those are more akin to government sanctions where you might engage in a back and forth because you disagree with policies by the government. What we see in the other countries, and this is true in Muslim ban 1.0, 2.0, and 3.0, is a wholesale blocking of every citizen from these countries. And the allegation or the justification for it is that, you know, anyone who happens to be from Libya or from Chad or from Syria or from Somalia, the risk is so high of nationals coming from those countries that we have to shut everyone down. And you referenced the court arguments. So there's two dueling Court of Appeals happening, one on in the Ninth Circuit on the West Coast and one in the Fourth Circuit. Yesterday, the day before yesterday, the Ninth Circuit arguments just reiterated the unconstitutionality of wholesale blocking an entire, you know, group of people from a country without pointing to the actual threats or distinguishing the actual threats from, you know, let's say Somalia versus another country that you have not banned. So I think those arguments are still going to be some of the strongest arguments for those challenging the ban. They were made yesterday, and I think they have been the basis for the findings so far for the temporary restrictions on these bans, from preventing them from going into place in almost every court that's heard them. And I'll just remind listeners that the Supreme Court did not, you know, make a decision based on the entire argument. They simply removed the temporary injunction from stopping the implementation. And the Supreme Court will take all of this up eventually when it gets there.
And that's because, I mean, you have two courts right now hearing arguments. Mm-hmm. This is obviously going to go to the Supreme Court.
And I just want to remind the audience that, you know, candidate Trump said that he's going to ban Muslims. And so this is not, you know, and he's playing on that. And there's enough evidence. And even as we heard today in the court arguments, the tweets and other things. So this is definitely targeting a religion. And that definitely plays to his unfortunate base that is supporting this type of narrative. And there are real consequences to just even talking about Muslims not being allowed to come to the United States.
So what are you hearing from people? Because we have seen, especially in recent years, people in our Somali community here in Minnesota going to Somalia to visit. I think, have you been there? Have you?
I've been there. I've been there this year as well. You know, the reality is that after the Muslim ban version one came up, majority of the people who are calling us and majority of the people who still call us today are people who should not be affected by Muslim ban version three. But citizens and people with green card holders, because it created a great deal of confusion and great deal of uncertainty. And then even more people who, as John also alluded to, other Muslims from other majority Muslim countries who are concerned about leaving the country. And some of them here on work visas, some of them here for other types of immigration statuses. So, I mean, I think the Muslim community looks at this ban differently. We see this as an onslaught, an attack on our community. And when we become a target of everyone out there to continue to attack this community. And so, you know, we are confident that the American people will stand with us and to defend the United States Constitution against this policy, which really is what the Supreme Court's role here. And they haven't made a decision. They just let this gave a little bit more life to this policy.
So if someone, you know, plenty of Somalis, you know, even if they were born in Somalia, they've been naturalized. They're citizens now here in Minnesota of the U.S. And so in theory, you know, you get your passport, you should be able to go back and forth.
Absolutely.
Is that the case, or are people just not going?
Well, you know, I think people with citizenships and who even with green card holders, you know, should be able to travel. But again, people are concerned. And even regardless of having a citizenship, people have had travel. Muslims historically, even in the Obama administration before, have had difficulty coming back into the country. And just this year alone, we had an imam who traveled back from Somalia to, I believe, Kenya and back to Utah, was barred from coming to the United States, even though he's a naturalized U.S. citizen. And we had to actually care and other lawyers, other partners actually had to file a suit to get him back. So people, when they hear those type of cases, they hear what's happened with these policies. A lot of people who might have wanted to go and have green cards and have U.S. passports still may choose not to go, not knowing the certainty of what's happening.
What are you telling, John, when people call your office with all of these scenarios?
Yeah, I would reiterate what Jelani said. One of the chilling effects, I think is a good way to describe it, of these orders is they are so dangerous because it alerts Muslims in mass, I would say, but also particularly people from the named countries that something's wrong with you from the point of view of the government. You're suspicious, or you're a second-class citizen, or that, you know, whatever protection you have can be revoked. And so that chilling effect, I think, you know, we've seen evidence of people being changing travel plans. We've seen what had been heightened scrutiny, you know, higher levels of questioning, even under President Obama, as Jelani pointed out, being taken up, you know, several levels since the first Muslim bans, and that culture of more aggressive and more intensive questioning by Border Patrol, unfortunately, does have consequences when somebody's detained overnight, when they miss flights. That word travels very quickly through the community, and it does chill the ease with which you should be able to feel just as equal as an American or just as equal as a permanent resident. And that's part of, you know, unfortunately, we have to let folks know if they call, and they should not be targeted or in any way vulnerable. We do also have to let them know, well, you should expect greater scrutiny or more questioning than you probably had the last time you traveled.
What about deportations, John? Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, it's really a separate conversation in, on one hand, but connected on the other.
Okay.
You know, what I would say, and there's been really good reporting done by the Star Tribune on this with Homeland Security data, there's a 75% increase in arrests in this sector by ICE in the Minnesota, Dakota's Office of Immigration, Customs, and Enforcement. And that's three times greater than the national increase. So there's a lot of activity here. You know, the big story of three Somalis who were saved from deportation in a very dramatic way by some colleagues of mine just last night, yet two more were deported. I think we'll ultimately see a pretty high number of Somalis were put on a plane yesterday and are being deported back. So this is affecting people from all over the world, not just Muslims, this increased ICE and deportation activity.
I'll just say that, you know, the Somali communities particularly feels that weight of the deportation in ICE. And I know that there are a number of Somalis who have been deported, including those who have of the Muslim faith and even Somalis who are not Muslim Christian. So, you know, this is definitely something that in the community there's a great deal of sense of fear. And we want to, but we want to, I guess, remind people that for those listeners today, you can do something. You can call your our local Congress and both senators, whoever replaces Franken, to at least be bold in the role the Congress and the state representatives or Congress can play around this issue.
Let's take a call here from George on line three, who's in Shakopee. Hi, George. Your question here today.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I think, and this is how I remember it, is this whole ban came about in because of the Syrian refugee crisis and a lack of their ability to vet these individuals from these failed states. And I'm wondering now that ISIS is defeated, how that might change things. And then lastly, this isn't a Muslim ban. It's a lack of administrative ability to vet these individuals. Thank you.
Thanks, George. John, your thoughts there. First of all, that first question, with what has happened in the Middle East with ISIS, does that change the game there? And then his other thoughts about, you know, the nations here don't have the capacity to do that.
Yeah, I'll start with the second one. I think there's been an intentional kind of misleading of the public, you know, it's unfortunate, but it's necessary for folks like me who work in this field to sort of set the record straight. So refugees are the most vetted individuals coming to the United States. And this was true, you know, ever since 9/11. We have dramatically increased the scrutiny of every visitor, but particularly people who are refugees. So there's a very, you can Google the refugee processing chain of events, and you'll see that every individual who comes to the United States goes through almost every national security agency before they make it here. I'll also remind listeners that, you know, the vast majority of people who are refugees in the world never get resettled. The United States only accepted this last year about 50,000, and the president, you know, dramatically decreased the number that we had committed to.
So, but
misnomer that somehow we're letting everybody in and nobody knows who they are.
But
that's simply not true.
But we're not just talking about refugees. I mean, there are other forms of immigration. And so the caller's point, we only have about a minute left here, but the caller was questioning whether these countries from which they're coming, if they're not refugees, how do we know that that screening is adequate enough? And is that a viable argument? And frankly, I don't know if that's something we're hearing from the Trump administration in these court cases.
Yeah, I mean, part of I don't want to say that other immigrants are not being screened, because that's not the case either. Okay. You know, I intentionally went back and said 9/11 really changed the way in which we think about national security and all types of immigration. The folks who came, you know, and committed those terrible acts in 9/11, of course, I think most people recognize we're not from any of the countries that are currently banned. Mm-hmm. We set in place a level of scrutiny for everybody coming to the United States that had not been seen before. Will it catch absolutely everybody? It's impossible.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we have to shut down entire countries without a justification or some sort of rationale to gauge one from the other. And unfortunately, we're operating in that situation right now.
And unfortunately, we have to leave it there. John Keller from the Immigrant Law Center, Minnesota, thank you for your time. We'll have you back as we update this story. And Jelani Hussein from CARE Minnesota, thanks as always for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.